You're listening to the public feed of Carefree Highway Revisited, which includes only a portion of this conversation. To hear the complete discussion, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or see the show notes for details.
The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
Minstrel of the Dawn is here to make you laugh and bend your ear. Up the steps you'll hear him climb, all full of thoughts, all full of rhymes. Listen to the pictures flow, across the room into your mind they go. Listen to the strings, they jangle and dangle while the old guitar rings. This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates the work of Gordon Lightfoot song by song, a proud member of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and along with me today is a fellow Lightfoot fan making her seventh appearance on the show, Deb Radwan. Deb, welcome back to Carefree Highway Revisited.
Thank you so much. I can't believe it's been seven times.
I know. Far and away a record, and one that I don't know if it'll ever be surpassed, but great to have you on again. So today we are talking about Minstrel of the Dawn from the Sit Down Young Stranger album. And of course, that record came out in 1970. And I have to tell you, you picked one of my very favorite Lightfoot songs, although it's one that is a little mysterious and not a whole lot has been written about it in terms of criticism, either positive or negative. It has had very little literary analysis. So I guess I'm wondering, why did you want to talk about it today?
Well, truthfully, this song was on my radar. I liked it. But then I saw him perform it in concert and it was magical. And ever since then, I've had a little bit more interest and it just moved up on the charts. There was something about him performing it that was just like, oh my gosh, this is magnificent.
You know, I was going to be asking you that a little later on. Had you ever seen him perform it in concert? And it would have been interesting for me because clearly he wouldn't have had the strings, which is an integral part of the song. The reason that I love it so much is it is a cinematic song like many of his good ones are, but it's also one of the songs where I know he's speaking autobiographically. That
some of it. I found out some stuff.
Okay, well, we will get into that.
Yeah.
It's just that my own impression is that he's referring to himself in the third person.
Yeah.
There's very few references to I in the song, but it has always seemed like he was in some way portraying himself, and there's different levels on which that happens. And we will get into those as we sort of delve into the origins of the song.
One of the things that I really love about this song too, is it's one, along with just a handful of others, where there seems to be a connection between the protagonist in the song and the audience. So you kind of get that with The Traveling Minstrel Show, If It Should Please You, maybe a little bit of Susan's Floor. There just seems to be some connection where he's talking to the audience. Go fetch some wine and set it here, you know? Mm-hmm. And I really like that connection, that intimacy of it.
I know that you said it was magical and when you saw him perform it in concert. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could describe that just a little bit more about what made it so magical, apart from just the fact that he was always magical in concert.
Yeah.
You know, there was always an aura about him. He was just a total professional, absolutely knew how to captivate an audience. What was it about that particular night?
Well, actually, I've seen him perform it several times. Of course, his finger picking and Carter's or Terry's, whosoever it was, and the combination that he's our troubadour and he's speaking about a troubadour, and it does sound autobiographical in a lot of ways. And when he says, listen to the strings, they jangle, you're listening to the strings jangle. It was just magical. I don't know how else to describe it.
It sounds like it was a moment where you really had to be there to hear the kind of narration of what he was actually doing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the lead guitar, because in this, if you take away the strings, it's only three pieces. It's guitar, lead guitar, and bass. There's no percussion on it at all. And it doesn't need anything else. I mean, the strings are nice on the record, but it doesn't seem to me that you had to have them.
And he didn't have them in the concert, and it was magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's because more of the focus was on the guitar. It was beautiful. And I think the other thing that made it special, and maybe we'll talk about it a little later, was he told the story about coming out of the coma. And this being the first song he heard. And he kind of set it up. He said, you know, when I was in this coma, my sister Beverly used to come in every day and she would play my music to me. He said, when I woke up, the first song I heard was this song. So then that kind of elevated it for me, you know, that whatever it was, this was the song that reached into that dark hole and pulled him out of it.
There's an extra layer of beauty to and meaning to
the
song. And I had heard that. I didn't hear the part about Beverly being involved.
Yeah.
But, but I had heard that when he was coming out of the coma, that he did hear the song. But I couldn't be sure if it was in his head or whether there was somebody actually playing it on a cassette or whatever. But the fact that it was in his head, I mean, that's really his welcome back.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And in Nicholas Jennings' book, he says, and I'm quoting here, it was sort of a hallucination. It happened just as I came to, and one of the nurses was filling up my feeding apparatus. The whole song with me singing, but sounding so much more pristine than on the record. It was the most amazing thing. So it was almost like all his senses were heightened and the music was almost a spiritual moment for him. So when he was telling this story and when I read it in the book, it was just like, yeah, there's something about it. When I heard him sing it live, him on the guitar, it elevated the song for me.
You know, to think about it being more pristine than on the record, it's hard for me to imagine anything more pristine than the way he delivered it. And I should segue into this by saying that this is one of a very few Lightfoot songs or any songs that I could listen to at any time doing anything under any circumstances. There are some where I'd really have to be in a particular setting, time, place, activity, whatever, for it really to hit home. But this is one where I could listen to it six times a day and throughout the day when I'm out and about my business, and it is always going to fit. Is there a setting for you that would be perfect for this, or is this another one that you could listen to anytime?
Well, I can listen to it anytime. I do find that I listen to my music most often in the car. But if I could describe a perfect setting, I think it would be having it play when the sun is coming up.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. The dawn.
And,
and of course, he did name his company Early Morning Music for many years. I don't know if he kept that moniker until the very end, but for a long, long time, that was the name of his publishing company. Well, let's talk a little bit about how the song got written. And again, going back to the Nicholas Jennings book, we do know that when Gordon was working in Cleveland, and I've talked about that at La Cave, when he was maybe in residency there, or he was playing a few shows there, he went to see Stepan Fetchit, who is the African-American comedian who was the first African-American to become a millionaire in show business in American history. And the name ended up in the song, but it's clearly not about the characters that that actor, whom we'll talk more about a little bit later, but the idea that this character will make you laugh and bend your ear. And so that was one of the few things that Jennings said about this song.
I read that as well, but I found an article that was written in 2008 by Red Shea's daughter. And I sought it out because I had heard somewhere that this song was written about Red. He was the inspiration. And so when I found the article, it was in the Globe and Mail. And what she wrote was, Gordon wrote a song called Minstrel of the Dawn that was inspired by Red. I believe it captured the playful life of my father that he possessed. He loved telling jokes. And of course, I kind of Googled Red just to get more information on him. He traveled in the carnivals. He jumped freight trains. He was a real jokester. And then one of the articles I read said, Red Shea is universally credited with having been Lightfoot's most distinctive original supporting player, adding his lucid filigree lead runs seamlessly into his music.
What a way to phrase that.
Yes. And when he said filigree lead runs, that's kind of what that song, when he talks about, listen to the strings, they jangle. That's kind of what I imagine is this filigreed music. So I think it's about Red. I'm sure there are some autobiographical aspects. I don't think you can keep that out of it. But I think Red was maybe the inspiration, his guitar playing, his joking around, kind of the checkered past of traveling with carnivals. And as a troubadour, they just travel all over. They really just go from place to place to place to perform. So I think it might be about Red.
You know, you've sold me. It makes perfect sense that it would be about Red. And this is a good place, Deb, to stop and talk a little bit about the whole idea of minstrel tradition.
Yes.
And of course, it goes back to medieval European times and maybe before. And the minstrels were wandering entertainers and they sang all sorts of songs, love ballads, epic songs, religious music. And then sometimes they would be sort of town crier kind of people, is saying, okay, well, here's what's going on in this burg or this area dozens of miles away where I was two nights ago. So kind of the news source, if you want to put it another way. It was very popular in the 1840s. And then a guy named Edwin Christie and the new Christie Minstrels, and get that name, who wrote Goodnight Ladies, among other things, and formed the Christie Minstrels. And then it became part of the music scene in the United States until about the 1950s. But of course, it took the form of shows that were very race-based and were not intended to be nourishing or edifying at all. I mean, they were really mocking African Americans. That being said, the tradition of the wandering troubadour really goes back hundreds of years. And it would not surprise me if we could have gotten inside Gordon's head, although I don't think he ever came out and said this. I think there's a very good chance that it was about Red.
And, you know, that troubadour, traveling minstrel, that goes back to the Renaissance. I mean, Henry VIII had troubadours in his court, and they would come out and do love songs. And I think of songs like Your Love's Return, the Minor Ballad, those all have a flavor of that minstrel sound where they're telling a tale or it's a love song, or even songs like Mr. Tambourine Man has a little bit of that quality. So I think there was a lot of inspiration there from the traveling troubadours and the minstrels from 1500s forward, and throwing a little inspiration there. And you've got a quintessential Gordon song. You know, that's just perfection.
And he did it so well. And we're going to start talking about why it was such a beautiful song right now. Well, that's all the time we have for here in the public feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this conversation, along with all of our other extended and bonus episodes, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com. You can see the show notes for details.